This is Sarah McCammon, author of The Exvangelicals, and you're listening to Footnotes with Jamar Tisby.
Hey, folks, welcome to another episode of Footnotes, bringing you news and views to help you become a more informed neighbor, advocate, and believer. I am your host, Dr. Jamar Tisby, and what a treat we have today. Folks, she's fairly a celebrity. If you don't know her by name, you know her by voice. She is Sarah McCammon, a national political correspondent for NPR and the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. Her work focuses on political, social, and cultural divides in America, including the intersections of politics and religion, reproductive rights, and the conservative movement. We're going to get a little taste of all of that in my conversation with Sarah about her forthcoming book, The Exvangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church, the Exvangelicals. It's described as rigorously reported and deeply personal. The Exvangelicals is the story of the people who make up this generational tipping point, including Sarah herself, part memoir, part investigative journalism. This is the first definitive book that names and describes the post-evangelical movement, identifying its origins, telling the stories of its members, and examining its vast cultural, social, and political impact. Full disclosure, I am interviewed and quoted in this book. It tells a lot of the story about The Witness. My Pass the Mic co-host, Tyler Burns, is interviewed and quoted in this book as well. And I thank Sarah in the interview for actually addressing the role of Black Christians within and around evangelicalism. I also endorse the book. Here's what I wrote, a little bit of it. I said, McCammon takes the scramble of thoughts, feelings, and fears that characterize this era of religious reexamination and makes them legible. This isn't just a book about what evangelicalism has become. It's also about the ways people are trying to find what comes next. I really enjoyed this interview. We wax nostalgic about the 90s and about evangelical subculture. We also talk about the role of journalism in reporting on evangelicalism, the role of politics in this movement. You're going to really get a lot out of it. Her book, The Exvangelicals, is available for pre-order, or you can buy it depending on when you listen to this, wherever books are sold. Enjoy this interview I have with Sarah McCammon about her book, The Exvangelicals. I feel like we have a celebrity in the house. Sarah McCammon, welcome to Footnotes.
Oh, that's, you're too kind. Thank you so much.
Well, I mean, tell us where you're calling in from. That's like part of the story.
I don't know, an undisclosed location with that happens to have radio studio soundproofing behind me.
Exactly.
We were... You know how it is to have a busy schedule and fit things in. So I'm fitting this happy to fit this conversation in between meetings at my employer. I just came out of a NPR Politics podcast meeting, and I'm heading into a taping for that later today. So
yes, which is so cool. Yeah, I mean, so I'm sure a bunch of our listeners tune into NPR and NPR Politics specifically. So thank you for joining us. I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit. But first things first, I know you grew up in Kansas City area. So congratulations that your football team is again Super Bowl champions back to back.
I know. Thank you so much. I know people have different feelings about football. I feel like it's talking about religion, you know, like I don't want to offend anyone, but yes, we Kansas Cityans are very happy.
Yes.
And I wrote a Substack. I have about the same level of affection for football as I do for Taylor Swift, or for the Chiefs as I do for Taylor Swift, which is to say, I like them both. They're both very talented, but I don't spend a whole lot of time and money on them. However,
you are just supporting the controversy. Yes,
I know, right? Last night was very exciting. And I think I do have to say that the last several months have been, weeks and months have been a lot of fun. So,
yeah, well, we can just call it what it really was, the Usher concert with some football around it.
That's so true, too, which I felt like it was kind of like a gift to aging millennials like myself. Like it was taking me back to my early 20s, you know, to like apartment dance parties, drinking like blue raspberry vodka with Diet 7-Up, you know, before I got old.
I was up and dancing. My teenage son was looking at me like, what are you doing? Who is this guy on TV? And why are you so excited about it? I'm like, you wouldn't understand. But one day.
I know. I do things now. My teenagers sit, look at me like that. And I say, that's cringy, isn't it? And they're like, you saying cringy is worse.
It's cringy. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yes, we're definitely, I loved reading your book, Exvangelicals, not only because the content was so amazing, but the cultural flashbacks were so rich and compelling, and they really, really took me back. So we'll get into that. I'm really excited. The way the book is described, it's really like the first book that's talking specifically about this Exvangelicals movement. And so you open with this really powerful scene, a reenactment of Jesus's crucifixion when you were younger. And I love the powerful way that you wrote this line. And I wonder if you talk about it more. You said, the blood might be fake, but the danger was not. That threat informed every aspect of my life as an evangelical girl growing up in Kansas City in the 80s and 90s. Talk about that opening scene and why you chose it to sort of frame the book.
Yeah, well, it takes place when I was a very young child, you know, at that age where you're just starting to sort of sort reality from fantasy and you know, that age where you're so primed to kind of believe everyone around you because they're the people that take care of you and that you love. And it's probably a familiar scene for people who grew up in churches and went to, you know, church passion plays, things like that. But I just described, you know, from the perspective of a, you know, very small girl, probably about age four, trying to make sense of what was happening around me. And, you know, growing up evangelical, this story of Jesus is so powerful and so moving and so central, and the stakes around it and getting it right and understanding it correctly and sharing it with people are so high. And so I think I was primed to sort of see this passion play in that way. And I described the fear that I felt, not understanding what was going on and not knowing for sure at that age if the blood was fake or real, or, you know, was this a performance or what was happening? I knew that Jesus had really died for us. And so, you know, what we were seeing up on stage, I knew it wasn't really Jesus, but I didn't know if somebody was really dying. And, you know, I was used to, I think, being told to believe in things and that they were really important and some of them were really scary. And so I think it just kind of fit into that paradigm that I existed within. But you know, that was so much of what motivated us, I think, in my mostly white evangelical congregation, was this idea that the stakes were really high. The danger to our souls, if we didn't get this right, was so high, and that we had the truth and we had to both make sure that we understood it correctly and that we shared it with the world. And that idea, I think, got a lot bigger than was a lot bigger, as I came to realize, than just having the quote unquote right religious beliefs. And that's one thing we can talk about. But it also began to be about a political project for many churches and many, many white evangelical leaders.
And a lot of what I study around modern day evangelicalism exists within that realm of threat and fear and anxiety, and everything and everyone is sort of out to get you. And so you have to rally and fight and battle this righteous battle. So I do appreciate that. And I think it is part and parcel of the broader story that you're telling about Exvangelicals. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit more about your upbringing, particularly sort of the branch of Christianity and the way of inhabiting Christianity that you grew up with.
Sure. So I was born, you know, in the early 80s. I'm an old millennial. And
same.
Yeah, it's okay. It happens. Yes. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, because as you say, there was this sort of sense of embattlement. And this is something that I talk about in the book, that and that many other scholars and historians and writers have written about before me very, very well. But I really wanted to paint a sort of visceral, granular picture of what growing up in that world feels like. And so, you know, there was this sense that it was sort of us against the world, and that we had to sort of fix the world. And I think that came from, again, a theological belief that became sort of fused with a political project, you know, quite by design. But, you know, when you're growing up in that world, it's not something you you really understand. It's just the world that you're born into. And mine, and I think it's important to say, you know, evangelicalism is such a big catch-all label, and we use it to talk about a lot of different things, and within it fall a lot of different beliefs and religious traditions, as you well know. But I'm basically talking about a theologically conservative Protestant American Christians who are mostly white and mostly politically conservative, but not exclusively. And, you know, there's a lot of overlap and cross-pollination between different ideas and movements within all of this. And so it gets really messy really fast. But all I knew as a little girl, you know, sitting in that church, was that we believed in Jesus. We believed in the Bible. We believed that you could just open up the Bible and read it literally for yourself. You should go to church and be in a community, but you didn't need a pastor or a priest or anybody to tell you what to believe. Although, if you deviated from what your pastor believed, there were consequences for that, sort of social and at least associably religious and spiritual consequences for that. Mm-hmm. So that's how it looked like from the inside. But, you know, as I got older, I came to realize that my particular sect was a non-denominational, charismatic. So we believed in speaking in tongues and laying on of hands. And we believed, you know, in a real closeness to God, and that God could speak to people directly. Which is something that, you know, as you know, not all evangelicals emphasize to the same degree, but many evangelicals who wouldn't call themselves charismatic do emphasize this closeness to God. In fact, I would say that most emphasize this idea that a relationship to God is personal and God can lead you, guide you, speak to you in some way. We really leaned into that idea. So that was my church community. My Christian school, which was a really influential part of my life, was in Kansas City. They drew from a variety of different churches, you know, and there were like one or two, maybe like Methodist or Lutheran mainline-y kids, but they had, you know, more conservative parents. There were some like me who went to non-denominational churches. There were a lot of Baptist church and Bible church people. And, you know, so the theology, the fundamental belief was the same, that you had to believe in Jesus to be saved. The Bible was literally true. Almost everybody voted Republican. But that school was a little stricter when it came to things like, you know, girls were expected to wear dresses every day, which my parents were fine with, but wasn't one of their personal beliefs. So I hope that just sort of paints a picture of the world I grew up in. But, you know, it didn't really matter. Our most fundamental idea was that, again, we had the truth. It was in the Bible. Salvation came through belief in Jesus, and we had to share that with the world.
I'm curious about your parents, because it seems like they were really serious about religion. I mean, they've got y'all in Christian schools. You're clearly going to church a bunch. It's shaping your home life. So, you know, what was their religious background? Did they have some sort of dramatic conversion? Did they go to a Billy Graham crusade? Were they raised this way? Where do you think that real strong religious adherence came from with your parents?
I mean, in short, they were not raised this way. They, I think, sort of caught the wave of the Jesus movement and then the moral majority, which was the political movement. And of course, as you know, groups like Focus on the Family, which I talk about a lot in the book, and which I think every evangelical kid or ex-evangelical kid has deep familiarity with, you know, that group, I think, is sort of a paradigmatic example of this fusion of the spiritual and the theological with the political. Like, there was really, it was really seamless. And there was, I think, an increasing, if you look at, you know, Dr. James Dobson, who started Focus on the Family, his trajectory, he starts out as primarily a psychologist, kind of what's been called like a Christian Dr. Spock, you know, a Christian parenting counselor. And he becomes this really influential political leader, at least by the time, you know, I'm a teenager in the 90s. And so for my parents, you know, I'm not sure that they set out on a journey intending to end up there. But the way they talked about their faith growing up was that they'd had a really powerful experience with Jesus. And, you know, my mom grew up Lutheran. My dad grew up pretty secular. I think they occasionally went to like a kind of a non-denominational or a some kind of a mainline Protestant church. Occasionally, it wasn't a big part of their life. Neither of his parents were deeply religious, as far as I know. His father wasn't, and his mother, I don't believe, was either. She passed away when I was young. But, you know, for them, like, they were, I think my father might have been vaguely culturally Christian, my mother a little bit more so, but it was kind of this more understated German Lutheran Midwestern, like, you know, her family all came from like these German immigrant communities who had, you know, everybody was Lutheran. It was just what you were. And I don't want to say that it wasn't sincere. I think it was a big part of their lives, but it was just experienced and performed in a different way than the kind of charismatic post-Jesus movement, evangelical Christianity of the, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s that my parents had embraced. You know, it just looked really different. And again, for them, they talked about having, my mom, especially when I was growing up, would talk about feeling like Jesus was calling her and wooing her and how becoming a Christian really transformed her life. And, you know, I don't want to tell my parents' story too much. I've had to talk about them to write a story about my own childhood. And, but I will say that, you know, I think for them, it was a sincere, deep conversion. And in many ways, I think I know they both would say that it made them better people. And I think there's certainly truth in that. You know, but then here I am, the next generation, and it looks very different for me and for ex-evangelicals in general.
Exactly. And I think that's part of the story, right? Like, there's so much nuance here in the sense of, here are, for example, your parents, who I think are representative of a lot of that generation, who had various different backgrounds growing up regarding religion, but then somehow encountered Christianity and Jesus, and it was real to them. Now they're having children and raising a family, and they want to pass this on, and they're doing the best they can, and they're accessing the resources that are available, be it Focus on the Family or the Moral Majority or something else. And so it's not this on at the personal sort of individual level, this sort of malicious, crafty, like, let's co-opt, you know, Christianity for a political agenda. It's real people doing the best they can with the resources and the knowledge that they have. And I think that humanizes it, which is what your book does in a lot of different ways. So thank you for opening up and sharing that. We've been tossing around this term ex-evangelical without sort of defining it or explaining it more. So I'm just wondering if you can talk about how you explain that term ex-evangelical.
Yeah. So, you know, as I've said, evangelical is this big umbrella term that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And it can encompass everything from what I would really say are ideas that have their roots in fundamentalism, things like, you know, the literal view of the Bible as being inerrant and absolutely true and, you know, directly from God, handed down in some kind of, you know, I mean, I think most fundamentalists would understand that it was written down by humans, but that it was directly inspired by God and that it's exactly the way that God intended it to be. And, you know, this view of Jesus Christ as the only way to God and as belief in that, you know, as the only way to salvation, belief in eternal damnation, those kinds of ideas I'm not a historian, but, you know, we're outlined, I think, 100 years ago in that book, The Fundamentals.
Yes.
that the term fundamentalism, I think, got its name from. But really, a lot of those ideas have infused evangelicalism. And if you ask most evangelicals what they believe, it wouldn't be that far off, I don't think. Now, there are certainly progressive strains of evangelicalism that are, you know, willing to talk about things like textual criticism of the Bible and maybe talk about inclusivist theology that would allow for people who, you know, maybe never heard about Jesus or maybe even are of a different faith to go to heaven. Or maybe they'd say, I don't really know what happens, but I think that Jesus is the way to God. Like, there's a whole spectrum. So I want to acknowledge that. But there is what I really wanted to get at with this book is the sense that there is a common basic belief system that I've outlined a couple times here. And there is a common culture. Yes. You know, it didn't matter if you went to a Southern Baptist church or a almost fundamentalist Bible church like mine, or a, you know, hands in the air charismatic church, I'm sorry, fundamentalist Bible church school, like my school was part of, or, you know, a hands in the air charismatic church like mine. The culture was very similar. Things, ideas like purity culture infused, I think, most of conservative Christianity in the United States, and even have bled into Catholicism to some extent. even ideas like creationism, like there might be a little more wiggle room on that. But I think if you look at data, it's an, you know, polling data, it's an incredibly influential idea among American Christians. And there's still a whole lot of skepticism, I think, around evolutionary theory, less than there used to be, but more than I guess I would have expected, particularly among Protestants. This is something the Catholic Church came to terms with a long time ago. But, you know, that's one example. And so there are all these things that if you grew up in some kind of conservative Christian church that was Protestant and mostly white in the United States, in the last several decades, there are things you're going to almost certainly have encountered and that were going to be part of your upbringing to one extent or another. And so for a lot of us, when you grow up and you meet gay people and you study science and you know, sort of look around and go, you know, not everything that was fed to us by this subculture was maybe 100% correct, or maybe it doesn't resonate fully with who I am and who I want to be in the world. And we can talk about the racial piece of it later, because I think one of the things I enjoyed about talking with you for the book when I interviewed you was just how, again, some of this white evangelical stuff cross-pollinates in, you know, churches that predominantly are made up of people of color. And of course, some churches are more diverse than others, but I'm, you know, so it gets really hard to sort of categorize. But the bottom line is there is this common culture, and for a lot of us, coming to terms with it and then in some way distancing yourself from it, remaking your own belief system, deconstructing, to use a word that's popular now. It's a shared experience, and it feels a certain way. And there's a certain sense of like loss, grief, confusion, fear, alienation, but also excitement, opportunity, challenge, discovery that comes with that experience. So to me, an ex-evangelical is fundamentally somebody that used to be an evangelical and wouldn't feel comfortable with that term anymore. And that can take a lot of different forms and a lot of different and have a lot of different reasons behind it.
Oh, so good. I'm super excited for folks to grab and read this book, because I think there's going to be so much that sounds familiar and that that they resonate with, because what you're touching on, which is so crucial to understand, is that it's not only about a religion or theology, it's about a culture.
Yes.
So there will be so much that resonates in particular around the music, the clothing, the leaders or spokespeople we looked to for as authorities, even that opening scene we talked about, a reenactment of the crucifixion. Like, I can remember seeing those a few different times growing up in this evangelical subculture, which I think you referred to as possibly the most powerful or influential subculture, which I think is spot on. So I really appreciate that you understand there's a cultural element to it. Now, you called yourself an ex-evangelical before you knew you were one. So what were, you know, a couple of the, you know, light bulb moments for you that said, maybe what I grew up with is not what I can continue to embrace?
You know, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is that I think for so many people who have in some way moved away from an evangelical community, there are these light bulb moments. And for a lot of people, it's not just one, it's many along the way. And it's a process and it's a journey. And there were several that were memorable for me. And it was fascinating and kind of cathartic to talk to lots of other ex-evangelicals, former evangelicals who had had those same kinds of moments of really cognitive dissonance, you know, experiencing something that just doesn't feel right. It doesn't sit right with you. And there were a lot for me around a lot of different issues. I talk about at that same church being brought at a young age to a seminar about creationism and asked, you know, were you there? You know, meaning, were you there? It's a reference to scripture. You know, were you there when the world was formed? You probably could quote it better than I could. But the question that the speaker was asking, and I think it was based on Ken Ham's materials, you know, the creation scientist. I was too young to know exactly what was going on or who was doing it, but it sure in retrospect, thematically aligned with a lot of what Ken Ham does. The question that was being asked was, were you there when the world was created? And the sort of rhetorical answer to that was, no, you weren't. So you don't know. And you can't know that we all evolved. And you can't know that the earth is, you know, billions of years old. The universe is billions of years old. So we should trust what's in the Bible because we have the word of God that tells us, right? And that was like an interesting idea, but as I got older, it quickly became really obvious to me that this idea that was being promoted in my church and in my Christian school textbooks was way out of alignment with what most people believed, even some Christians or people who called themselves Christians. And so, you know, that was one thing that always kind of felt confusing to me and I struggled with, but it seemed like it was such a big deal. And then one of the central characters in this book is my grandfather, who I don't think it's spoiling too much to say was a gay man who was closeted much of his life and came out after my grandmother died. One of the stories I sort of tell throughout the book is how I became aware of that and how I came to terms with it. And because I did have to come to terms with it because of the way I was raised, it was something that was very difficult for my father to accept about his father and something that was hidden from me for a long time. And so I tell that story. And, you know, I think that is emblematic of what happens for a lot of people. You have a relationship with somebody who's different from you, who doesn't fit into the sort of rubric of what the church says people are supposed to be like, or doesn't fit into the hierarchy, or it might even be yourself doesn't fit in, you know, if you're a woman or a person of color or a queer person, you know, none of us fully fit in. But whatever that is, or those many things are, it forces a soul searching and a reckoning inside. And so the book is really about how I did that soul searching, what that looked like for me. And I really wanted it to be in conversation with the stories of a lot of other ex-evangelicals, because as I've said before, everybody's story is different, but there are the journey feels, I think there's similar feelings that most people go through because of the way that this culture, this subculture sort of gives you this built-in community and all these answers to life's most important questions. To walk away from all of that is very painful. But a lot of us, I think, felt like we had to walk away from it, at least to some degree, in order to follow a path that resonated with our sense of what was right and true.
For sure. And just to name what I'm sure a lot of us are thinking, there's a reticence on behalf of many to even use that name evangelical anymore. Mm-hmm. If we ever were really self-conscious about it, like probably not a lot of us called ourselves evangelical, but we were in that culture. And if somebody called us evangelical at that point, we wouldn't have been offended. But now it comes with all of this baggage, cultural, political, social, that many of us are consciously moving away, not only from that label, but from the culture you describe. I'm curious, and by the way, this is a really neat book because it blends that memoir and autobiographical aspect with your specialty, journalism and investigative journalism. So you talk to a bunch of different people, get a bunch of different perspectives. So it's not a monolithic sort of take on what's happening. But I am curious how you would name why this has come together sort of as a movement now, right? Because we've all had those moments where we've experienced where we don't quite fit or we don't quite agree with what this culture is promoting. But now there seems to be a sort of, you know, en masse realization of this and movement away from evangelicalism. So what's happening now, or what's in the air that it seems to have coalesced?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was quote unquote deconstructing in my 20s, there was no word for it. There was no way to really, I mean, there were people who'd written books, memoirs here and there about, you know, growing up in a conservative religious environment and leaving it. And I read some of them and they were helpful, but you know, the word we used in my church for people who moved away from the faith in any way was backsliding. It was this really dark, like you did not want to be called a backslider. And there, you know, there are ways that these communities sort of enforce belief and enforce staying in. I think it's like almost a joke online now. That if you start to question too much, you'll get invited to coffee, you know, by the pastor or by a well-meaning, you know, co-congregant. And something like that happened to me. I didn't even write about it in the book, but early in my, I think, what I would now call deconstruction, somebody invited me to lunch and I thought it was just a friendly hangout. And it turned out that it was a spiritual intervention, right? Yeah. So we've all been there. And so that is very scary and painful, especially when you're like, I don't want to get this wrong. It's not like I don't want to follow the right path or love God or even be a Christian, but did you
post something on social media or say something or ask the wrong question? Like, how would they have known?
I don't even know. This was like 2004, you know, like I think she just sensed that I was maybe I said something, or maybe because I was a journalist. I don't know.
Right. Yes. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. But you know, and I said, you know, the word deconstruction, that is a word that exists largely because of the internet. I mean, there's a whole philosophical school or meaning of the word deconstruction that I'm not going to go into because it doesn't really apply to this. But the way it's used online now, and words and hashtags like exvangelical, which was coined by Blake Chastain, the podcaster and writer, those kinds of things did not exist when I was in my early 20s. There was nowhere to go. There was nobody to really talk to unless it was in whispers and people that you felt you could trust. And so I think that one thing that's happening is that there is just, you know, the internet and social media and podcasts have democratized communication of all kinds in a way that now, if you are feeling uncomfortable with your religious community and asking questions and wanting to, you know, maybe read about evolution or maybe read about biblical criticism or maybe talk to people who are in a different tradition than your own about what that's like. Like, there are so many places and spaces to do that. So that's one thing. And then I think the other thing, you know, this book isn't just about Donald Trump and it's not intended to, you know, this book is not intended to tell people how to vote or who or what party to be part of. That's really not the point. But the Trump movement, I think, was a catalyst for a lot of these conversations online, because a lot of people found themselves soul searching and going, you know, is this really what evangelicalism is? And do I want to be part of it? So while it's deconstruction and ex-evangelicalism really predates Trump, it's not a new thing. I think that this moment in our political and cultural history has been a decisive one for a lot of people. And you know, I'm not the first person. Plenty of, I think, historians and sociologists and journalists before me have noticed over the last many years the increasing alignment between what we think of as evangelicalism and a particular political project. I keep using that term, but it really is. Yeah, you know, sure. So for people who think of themselves as Christians, as you know, wherever their specific theology might be, that evangelical label, I think for a lot of them, feels uncomfortable because it says something not about their faith, but about their politics.
You nailed it. Absolutely. And it is a political, I write about this a bit in The Color of Compromise in the sort of final chapters and the rise of the religious right. And it really self-consciously, intentionally became identified with a political project. And we'll get to a little of that, as well as, you know, the role journalism plays in helping or preventing some of this harm. But first, I want to talk about some of the racial contours of the ex-evangelical movement. First of all, I mean, I don't generally use that term ex-evangelical because to me, it's always been coded as white. People of color didn't come up with the term, and the way it was being discussed online, on social media, on podcasts, was very much, from my hearing, a white experience of it. So from what I understand, you're using ex-evangelical as a general term of sort of people who were in but are now, you know, exiting. And so it's not
in sort of a conscious way. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a conscious way. I appreciate that. The other thing I appreciate is, to my knowledge, you give the most extended treatment of what I, The Witness, my pastor, my co-host Tyler Burns, what we went through in this, particularly that, like, that 2016, 2018 sort of season of our nation's history. So thank you for that. Paying attention to that story. And the question is, in your research, in your investigation, what role did race and racism play in the ex-evangelical movement that you discovered?
I think that's such a good question. And I want to say too, thank you for talking to me for the book. I was thinking about writing something about the post-evangelical experience and deconstruction and all the reasons, all the cognitive dissonance points that push people out. When I saw some of the work you and others were doing around the Leave Loud hashtag and critiquing white evangelicalism. And, you know, I felt like it was important. I'm a white woman, right? I left a white evangelical space. I grew up in a white evangelical space. And so I can't speak to the experience of evangelicals of color or Christians of color in general. And there could be many more books written about just this topic, probably best not written by me because it's not my story. But I wanted to be in dialogue with some of those conversations because I thought it was important what you've said, which is, and I think I quote you in the book as saying that you don't tend to use this term. And I know others have told me this too, some of whom are Christians of color and others who just find the evangelical hashtag or the term to be maybe a little angry. And I want to say I use it loosely. Mm-hmm. I think it communicates, I was part of something, now I'm not, but it doesn't tell everybody's story and everybody's story is different. But I think you're right that it is largely a white space. And, you know, that makes sense because we're talking about predominantly white churches that people leave. So most of those people are white people. I did talk to some people. I have encountered people along the way in my research who were white, who were really hurt by the way their churches responded, for example, to the George Floyd murder in 2020, a sense of, you know, callousness by their pastors, a sense that the church wasn't taking racial issues seriously enough. I can't say that it's the primary motivating factor for most white people. I mean, I think a lot of people, and I tell some of these stories, have many other reasons aside from just that. But I love what you say about decolonizing Christianity, and it's something I think about a lot. It's a question that I have, which is, you know, would I have been able to stay in Christian spaces more comfortably had some of the other voices of Christians of color, of women, been heard and listened to more carefully? I mean, what would our even understanding of Christianity be if we had, you know, from the earliest years of the church, included those voices equally? I don't think we even know. We can't possibly know because this is a tradition that we're part of that's been handed down, you know, in an incredibly imperfect, broken world. And so I don't have the answer to that. But I do think that listening to the voices that haven't been on the stage front and center, which are usually white, straight men, it's critical if, you know, especially for anybody that wants to stay engaged with Christianity and maybe is uncomfortable with the way it's going. Well, maybe if we listen to and platform some of those other voices more, maybe that's the path forward, you know, for some kind of, I think you talked about redemption. And yeah. I mean, to me, that's the whole point of Christianity is redemption and hope and, you know, taking something that maybe is broken and healing it. So.
This is why my interest is always piqued when journalists write books, because number one, y'all are much better at writing for reader interest than scholars and historians typically are. And then number two, you're bringing those journalistic standards and practices into your work of saying, well, let's hear from the people who are maybe not platformed or mainstreamed and get some other perspectives here. So I think that's important. You mentioned decolonizing, and shout out to Akemene Uwan of Truth's Table, because that's one of the other ways that Black Christians sometimes distinguish this movement from one thing to another thing. A lot of times people will use that term deconstructing, which can mean a lot of different things. For many people of color, decolonizing, although I would say we all need to decolonize no matter your race or ethnicity, but decolonizing is sort of more a more specific term. It's understanding Christianity apart from whiteness and the ways that whiteness has sort of colonized and even co-opted our understandings of the faith. But you really do address that with sensitivity, and even the fact that you do address that, I think this makes this book really valuable for a much broader swath of people. I want to dig into the journalism aspect for a moment. First of all, in your own story, I'm curious where that came up in your life, when this interest came. And then from your Christian community, what was the response to Sarah going this journalistic route? You know, it's not the sort of wife homemaker thing. It's not the missionary dream. It might cause a little stir, did it? And how did you discover this passion?
Yeah, I think bottom line, what drew me to journalism in retrospect, although I would not have articulated it at the time in this way, but I understand now that when I look back on myself and when I was making those choices, I think I was really drawn to a space where the point was to ask questions, not to arrive at answers, not to promote an ideology. And I know plenty of people will hear that and say, journalists don't do that. And of course, I come to this book and my work with my own story, and I'm pretty transparent about what that is here. So I don't pretend to be like some kind of objective, you know, brain in a vat with no feelings or personal biases or experiences. I do really highly value the ideal of trying to, you know, not necessarily objectivity, because I think we do have to be self-reflective about the fact that that's pretty much impossible for any human being who lives in a body and in a culture, but at least this ideal of trying to get at the truth. And I think that means, you know, one thing that journalists have to do, and I think critical thinkers in general, is be willing to come at things from different angles, be willing to engage with people you disagree with, even people that maybe have really bad, awful ideas, but like ideas that are influential and that we need to understand in order to kind of understand how to move forward or just sort of comprehend what's happening. This is something that, of course, historians do too, right? Like do a lot, right? I mean, they look at ideas, whether they're good or bad, and just try to understand them and see how they shape, you know, public thinking and public policy and so forth. And so for me, that was really fascinating. And to just sort of have permission to ask questions and even encouragement to ask questions and not arrive at a specific answer was very exciting and freeing. Mm. I think I felt a lot of guilt about some of the questions that I had growing up around things like creationism. And like even, you know, in the 90s was kind of the early push, you know, to ban same-sex marriage. And at that time, you know, I grew up in a context where everybody believed that, you know, God created man and woman, and that's how it was supposed to be. But I struggled to understand why that moral belief should be translated in the minds of a lot of the people I went to church with into a law, you know? And so I remember kind of trying to figure out like, well, if we believe certain things in our church, should we try to make them laws? And when, you know, where do those things come together and where should they come apart? And I think journalism gets at that. It's about ideas and the sort of, a lot of my job as a reporter is just to talk to people about how they form opinions and often political opinions. But I love to talk to them about what's underneath that. Like, what's their religious background? How did they grow up? What are their experiences that have shaped that perspective? So for me, it was like a blank canvas, you know, that was so exciting. But I do, you know, maybe ironically have to give some credit to my dad who, you know, I try not to talk about my parents too much, but he's had a career in communications. And I think I grew up watching him, in various areas of media and communications do that kind of work. And I've always loved just words and writing and talking to people. And so it felt kind of like a natural thing for me. You know, I was really, and I talk about this in the book, very much encouraged to think about my life as a future wife and mother, but like everything, there's a spectrum, right? And so I was encouraged to go to college. And sometimes my mom talked about it like it was a, you know, a backup plan in case I didn't get married and have kids. But they did tell me to go to college. And I think my dad had a little bit different take on that and didn't, you know, encourage me in my interest in journalism from a young age. So, you know, I think ironically, some of it's because of the world I was raised in. And I grew up like steeped in ideas. We were thinking a lot about like what was right and what was wrong and what was true and what was good. And while the answers I've arrived at, if they're even answers, are different than, you know, my pastor growing up would have espoused, I think, though, that environment of critical or of thinking and questioning and caring about values, I think that did have an influence on me. And of course, I've taken it in my own direction, which is what we all have to do when we live our own lives.
Well, I'm really glad you did, because I feel like with you, we have someone in a very important organization that is helping to shape opinions and report on these issues, who actually understands the evangelical subculture. It seems to me that even to this day, there's a lot of very superficial understanding and really misunderstanding of whose voices are influential, the spectrum of beliefs within evangelicalism, and how that impacts our national story. So thank you from all of us who have lived in this culture and want someone who really understands it to be able to report out about it. But it's getting, it seems, increasingly precarious for folks in journalism. So you talk about this turn that you felt as a journalist around the 2016 presidential election cycle, how it got really kind of contentious, tense. And I wonder if, you know, what does it feel like now in 2024? Same, better, worse?
I think, you know, attacks on the press have always been a tool that politicians have used when they're unhappy with reporting about them. And that is somewhat par for the course. And I understand that. I do think that Trump took that to a new level without question, and has continued to take it to a new level. I think, you know, as I think our country is in a place now that seems increasingly, this is no profound insight, but I think polling suggests, and I think conversations with average people suggest, that we are in many ways more polarized. And I think a lot about why that is, and how we got here, and how we can, I certainly don't have the answers for how to get away from it. I think that journalism is obviously essential to a free society and our democracy. And I think a lot about our role in that, but then, you know, I think you can sit and think about it and get a really big head and realize that, like, sometimes, I mean, the craft is really just about doing the next story, trying to provide a little bit of insider information. You know, sometimes it's about taking the time to understand an issue so that people who have real jobs don't have to spend the same time, you know, reading court documents like we do. That's right. But I'll say, you know, it's for me, the last 8 years have been a time of a lot of soul searching. I didn't necessarily want to end up where I am, which is writing about white evangelicalism. I mean, I spent a lot of time not talking about it at work and trying to sort of hide some of the, frankly, gaps in my cultural and educational background. I mean, there were things I missed in Christian school and Christian college that I have had to catch up on. Like the first time I did a science story, there was a lot of research I had to do. Yeah. And then just, you know, growing up in this subculture and being pretty sheltered, there were things that I missed that I think when I got into a secular workplace, I realized, you know, I think everybody feels like they don't fit in sometimes, but there were times I thought, I had a different experience than most people, and I'm going to have to figure out how to work around that. But then 2016 kind of put it all in my face, and suddenly everybody wanted to kind of know, like, anybody who knew anything about my background, which you can't totally hide when you went to a Christian college, you know. Anybody who knew that about me really wanted to kind of know, like, well, why are evangelicals rallying around Trump? That perennial question. What does this mean? How do they think? And so I found myself kind of digging back into that history and that knowledge that I carry with me from growing up in that culture. And I'll be honest, it's hard sometimes. Like, it's emotional sometimes and maybe you can relate to this because you kind of work in this space that's tied in with your own journey. But you know, it's a privilege. And I felt like when I've been able to take that information and I hope ask better questions sometimes, or maybe craft writing that's a little more specific, that's, you know, I don't ever want to, like, defend or apologize for or advocate for or against anything except as much as I can, what I see as, you know, just the truth, like, just kind of call it like I see it. That's what I try to do. And I don't claim to do it perfectly, but that's my goal. But it's challenging. I mean, it's, you know, I loved writing this book. It was very cathartic. I love talking to people who have walked similar journeys, but I want the next one to be about something completely different. You know what I mean? And I hope that eventually our country can move into a healthier place. And, you know, that those of us who have left some of these spaces can also find healing and a path forward that isn't just about looking back. And I think it's really important to look back and understand, but I think it's also important to look forward and build new communities. And that's something else that I kind of touch on near the end of the book, is how people are thinking about where do they find meaning? Where do they find spiritual guidance? And the answer is different for everybody, but I think looking for those answers is really important. It's a really important part of being human.
100%. As someone who pays attention to these things a lot more than most, a journalist looking at politics and specifically the intersection of religion, if you will, what are some things that are on your radar that you're paying attention to as we go toward the 2024 November elections?
There's no longer really a question about what white evangelicals are going to do when it comes to Trump. I think by and large, the data that we've seen and the results of some of the early primaries indicate that people who continue to identify as white evangelicals, and obviously a lot of people don't anymore, people identify as evangelical are as, you know, on the whole, still supporting Trump. But I think one of the things that I'm hearing about as I talk to pastors, and I was in Iowa, I talked to some pastors there of various persuasions, you know, mostly Republicans, but some were not backing Trump in the Iowa caucuses and others were. But one thing I heard from a couple people was just a sense that this political moment had created division in some of their churches for the people who remained, and had also led to just an increasingly kind of extremist wing of both the religious movement and the political movement. You know, one pastor told me he was concerned about some of the people he in his circles who saw Trump in kind of a messianic way, almost like the fulfillment of some kind of prophecy. And this was a guy who I think was pretty conservative, but didn't like that kind of language and didn't like its infusion with this, you know, spiritual belief that was part of his tradition. This was a guy who was from sort of the Pentecostal tradition. He said, you know, that means something in my world. And so I think I'm curious about, you know, not only how these trends will shape our politics, but also churches. You know, where does American Christianity go from here? And I don't have the answer to that, but it's something I'm curious about.
Well, if I could sort of end on a little bit of a personal note, and feel free to go as deep or not deep into this as you want, but where does Sarah go from here? As someone who knows this culture, who's on a journey, how would you describe where you are now?
Yeah, I think I'm still on a journey. I feel like it's so cliche to say I don't use a lot of labels, but I have moved away from labels because I feel like labels don't serve me very well. And I feel like the second you put on a label, whether it's a religious one or a political one, you start to sort of feel beholden to that label and all the baggage that goes with it. And I'm not against labels. I think sometimes they serve a purpose, but I also think like we can use them or lay them down as they're useful for us. You know, I'm still somebody that like every day, many times a day, thinks about what's right and wrong. What does God want? I do believe in God. I pray. I'm in an interfaith marriage. My husband's Jewish. And so that's been a whole different sort of chapter of my life and a fascinating and really meaningful one to learn about my tradition juxtaposed to his. And, you know, there are obviously similarities and differences, but it's been fascinating. You know, David Gushy, who I quote in the book, who's an ethicist at Mercer and a scholar of Christianity, he talks about the way that he thinks that Christians should learn from some of those traditions and the way that the Talmud and the Torah were historically interpreted within Judaism. And I think that's really true. I think there's so much to learn. And I guess that's where I'll leave it, is I feel like I still have so much to learn. I read a lot of religious history and I think about it probably way too much. But I have become more at peace with the idea that I don't have to sign a contract, fill out a form, take a test. Like, I don't think that's what spirituality is or what God asks of us. And I really believe deeply that every person is made in God's image. And I think if there's anything that I hope guides me or try to live by, it's that belief. And I think that sort of encompasses, you know, everything Jesus said about the golden rule. If you believe every person around you is in the image of God, then it will shape the way you treat them. Now, I don't always live up to it, and I don't expect other people to believe the same way I do or even to believe in God, you know. But for me, that's a really meaningful idea. And I just, you know, I'm less fearful, I think, than ever, and more excited to learn and explore those things. And honestly, I think that's one of the gifts that writing this book gave me was feeling more at peace than I did even before I wrote it.
I believe a lot of folks who read the book will also feel more at peace, and where you are in your journey describes where a lot of people are or hope to be. So the book is The Exvangelicals. What's the best way to get our own copies and to keep up with your work?
So there's a website that Macmillan, the publisher, has. It's published by St. Martin's, which is an imprint of Macmillan. If you just Google The Exvangelicals and Macmillan, it'll pop up, and you can order from any number of places, local bookshops or the big ones that we've all heard of, or you can just go to one of the big ones if that's what you want to do. I'm not going to judge. I'm on Substack. That's probably the best place to find me. My Substack is called Off the Air because it is what I write when I'm not at work. And so sometimes it's about work. It's a little bit of an insight into what it's like to be a radio journalist, but it's also stuff about having two teenage boys and all kinds of other nonsense. So that's one way you can find me. I am on Twitter, regrettably, X. And my DMs are open. So that's another way too.
Well, I can testify. I follow your Substack, and everyone listening should subscribe. Thank you so much for joining us on Footnotes.
Well, thank you. And thank you again for being part of the book. I learned so much from our conversation. I loved our conversation. I'm so glad you were one of the people I was able to talk to for it. So thanks for bringing that insight. And thanks for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Absolutely.